We
are.
We
are.
We are cultivate.
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 We are cultivate.
Hello and welcome to Ye Olde Crime, where we discuss the funny, strange, and obscure crimes of yesteryear. I'm your host, Lindsay Valenti, and with me is my sister and co-host, Maddie Stengel.
Hello.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's going.
It's a happy eclipse day.
I was just going to say, happy solar eclipse day, which we will not see because we are in Minnesota. And also because it's rainy. So even if we could see it.
We can't.
We can't. All right. Before we get started, I do want to shout out our friend Carrie Ann, who has agreed to be my research assistant for the show. So that's really cool. So moving forward, she's going to help me by doing the bulk of the heavy lifting as far as like finding source material for me, so then I can just go in, pull what I want from it to write the episodes, which is super helpful because a good chunk of it is like just finding sources. Yeah. So
thank you so much, Carrie Ann. You're the best.
Thank you, Carrie Ann. I really appreciate it. So this one and the next two she's already done for me, and then I'm going to start giving her more as we get closer to the next month.
Wow. That's awesome.
So yeah. And funnily enough, even though it was hard to find a whole lot of information about this week's case, the information that we did find, there was a ton of it. So that's why I had a hard time getting this done in time.
That's okay.
And that's because we are going to be discussing the Stillwell murder.
Ooh, Stillwell.
I haven't had a good old-fashioned murder in a while, so...
It's been a while since we had just a pretty cut-and-dry murder. You're right.
Yeah. So this is a good way to segue you back to murders.
There you go.
Information was pulled from the following sources. A 2018 Murder by Gaslight article by Robert Wilhelm. 2016 Mary Lou Montgomery blog post. 1908 The Stillwell Murder or Society Crime Book by Minnie T. Dawson, 1895 The Chicago Chronicle article, 1890 St. Louis Post-Dispatch article, 3 Find a Grave links, Marion County Genealogy Village article, and Wikipedia.
Nice.
And links to all of these articles will be included in the show notes. Got something you want to say? Shoot us an email over at yieldcrimepodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your story ideas, see any gifts you send our way, or if you just want to say hello. We're pretty friendly. Speaking of friendly, if you'd like to have real-time conversations with us, consider joining our Discord over at the Cultivate Network. You can chat with us over at the Old Crimers Cubby, or catch up with any of the other great creators that are part of the Cultivate family of podcasts. Just click the link in our show notes, or over on our link tree to get started today. Today's story takes place in Hannibal, Missouri, located on the Mississippi River and incorporated in 1845. It's most famous for being the childhood home of Samuel Langhorne Clemens, a.k.a. Mark Twain.
Nice. So this is a later, cutting it close to our 1900s.
This is a little bit later, As of 2022, it was home to just under 17,000 people, and in the winter of 1888 to 1889, it was the center of a brutal murder trial involving one of the town's social elite.
Oh, even more scandalous, because it was highfalutin folks.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Amos John Stillwell was born on April 20th, 1828 in Kentucky. I couldn't find out anything about his family history as far as, like, his parents and any siblings are concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But he married a young woman named Mary E. Holden in 1854. She was 10 years his junior, making him 26 and her 16 at the time of the marriage.
I hate that. I know it was common then. I hate it. I hate it so much.
I feel like under 20 is just like kind of gross. Like, I know like most states you're technically legal at 18. Like everywhere you're kind of legal at 18, at least in the United States. But like gross.
Yeah.
The pair had one child together, Richard Holman Stillwell, in 1856.
That is such an old man name for a baby.
I know. I know.
I immediately picture like a 60-year-old man.
Well, and in pictures that I have found of him like later in life, he looks like such a like stereotypical Richard, little old man. And Mary passed away on August 7th, 1868 at the age of 29.
Oh, wow.
I couldn't find out why she passed, if it was, I'm assuming it was some sort of illness.
Yeah.
Because that's pretty young to just randomly pass away. Mm-hmm. Amos remarried on November 15th, 1870 to a woman named Frances Crooks Fanny Anderson. Fanny was her nickname.
Oh, yeah.
20 years his junior. She was 22 at the time of their marriage, while Amos was 42. The pair had met when Amos visited Indiana after the death of his first wife to visit relatives. He was so smitten with her that he proposed marriage.
Gross. So this is like shortly after she died.
They married 2 years after she died.
They met because she died.
Yeah. I don't know how long their relationship was prior to them tying the knot. I don't know.
Okay. Oh, God, 22 years.
Fanny herself had been looking for a way to get out from under the thumb of her stepmother. And prior to Amos's proposal, she had been contemplating entering a convent.
Oh, dang. So she was just desperate.
Yeah, she was like, I need to get out of here. Mm-hmm. And so when given the choice to marry a rich older gentleman versus entering a life in the church, you can kind of see how Amos had his own appeal.
Yep.
The couple would have three children together, Molly in 1874, so 4 years after they were married, Harold Anderson in 1881, and Earl Gulick in 1865. Earl Gulick Stillwell. What a name.
What a name. It sounds like they threw up mid saying the name, and that's just what the doctor or nurse wrote down. She's like, really?
How they spelled Earl is E-R-L-E, Earl.
Oh.
Yeah, I had to double check it. That's what it is on his tombstone. I was like, oh, that is.
Because then that to me just thinks early.
That's unfortunate. So before we move on, I want to give a little more background on Fanny. So she was born on November 1st, 1848 in Maysville, Kentucky, to parents Charles Bingley Anderson and George Ann Kulick Anderson. George Ann.
That guy really wanted a namesake.
Yeah. She had one younger sibling, Mary Dorsey, who was 20 years her junior.
Oh, so similar kind of age gaps in the family, I guess.
Yeah, so. Fanny was described as having beautiful, dark flowing hair and a lovely complexion. She was well educated. She went to school at the convent. She was musically inclined and quite the conversationalist. Nice. She quickly rose in the ranks of Hannibal's high society, despite her young age, and had a high temper and a strong will that could rival that of her husband. So she could, like, hold her own.
Yeah. Which normally is awesome and badass, but it's always seen as being like a bitch.
Yeah.
If you're a lady.
Yeah. Amos was the senior member of a pork packing firm that he ran with his cousin, John E. Stillwell, and later his eldest son, Richard H. Stillwell.
So they made a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Named Stillwell & Co., the success of this business venture allowed Amos to purchase a nice home on 5th Street between the cross streets of Broadway and Church. It was like a really nice home, like two-story, lots of bedrooms, you know, bigger home, close to the downtown area of Hannibal. So it was in like a very attractive neighborhood.
Nice. So it was kind of like getting in on the action. of the city as it was kind of booming.
Yes. On the night in question, December 29th, 1888, Amos and Fanny had spent the evening at a card party at a neighbor's, Dr. and Mrs. W.A. Munger, where Fanny won the first round of a game of euchre.
I've heard of it.
Although the gathering was small, it was full of the wealthy and social elites of Hannibal. So there were like a bunch of doctors there, like a judge and some others, with the Stillwells being some of the wealthiest in attendance.
Got it. So they would have been sought out.
Yes.
Probably more than others.
Well, and it was a big deal because Amos, because he's older, he didn't tend to go out much. Like, he was a bit of a homebody.
So getting his attention anywhere in like a social setting where you can network is huge.
Yeah. So him being there was a big deal because he typically did not go out. During the party, the boys were at home being watched by two of the Stillwell's servant girls, Josie Brown and Lizzie Julius, while their 14-year-old daughter Molly was in Quincy visiting relatives. Amos started to get tired around 11:30 p.m., so he and Fanny bid their goodbyes and walked the short distance from the neighbors back to their home. It was like two blocks back to their house.
Yeah.
Upon getting home, Fanny dismissed the servants and took the boys upstairs with her to put them to bed. Even though Amos and Fanny shared a bedroom, their sons slept in a separate bed in the room with them.
Yeah, I feel like that was typical, especially if they were younger.
Yeah, it was pretty common. And that evening, Fanny shared the bed with her young boys, Harold, who was 7, and Earl, who was 3.
Yeah, that makes sense.
All was quiet until around 2 a.m. when Fanny was awoken by a noise in the bedroom, followed by Amos calling out, "Fanny, is that you? Fanny, is that you?"
Oh, that's unsettling.
Yeah.
That's really not a good way to wake up.
No. According to the August 18th, 1895 edition of the Chicago Chronicle, quote, "She was awakened and saw an evil-looking person standing at the foot of her husband's couch. She was in another bed in the same room with two of the children. She heard a whirring sound as the murderer whirled an axe over his head, and she ducked down under the bedclothes. She fainted and knew no more for some moments. His body lay partly out of bed. The head and upper part of the body hung over the bed, and the toes were on the floor. The left side of the face was exposed, showing a gaping wound made by an axe 4 inches long," end quote.
That's so horrific.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. Those poor boys.
I think, based off what I read, how the room was set up is there were some chairs like next to the bed. And I think it was so like it would prevent the youngest one from falling out of the bed.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the way it was positioned, they were shielded from seeing their parents' bed. And she ushered them out very quickly after this, before they could see anything.
Oh, so she was out for just a short period of time then?
She just kind of like passed out for a second. And like during that time, whoever was in the room had fled. So when she like came to, it was just the four of them again. And then she grabbed the kids and ran.
Crazy.
Fanny's recollection of events after discovering her husband get a bit muddy, but she does recall grabbing the screaming boys and taking them back to the servants so they could be safe while she ran out of the house in her nightgown to the home of the Leagues, her next-door neighbors. Quote, "Mr. William League, accompanied by a young man in his employ, ran across the street and found Mr. Stillwell in a half-kneeling position. The body was almost immersed in blood. Across the left ear and left side of the head, there was a horrible gash, deep enough to penetrate the brain, and which had evidently been inflicted by some sharp instrument," end quote.
That's a lot of power.
Yeah.
That was a strong person if they were able to puncture the skull with an axe. Like, I don't think people really realize how resilient your bones are like with that. That's holy smokes. That's scary.
Mr. League, who had been accompanied by his servant, Jacob Cornder, quickly summoned all the nearest doctors, including Dr. Hearn, Dr. Allen, and Dr. Gleason. So they all kind of lived close by.
Mm-hmm. I suppose if there's any place to have an emergency, it would be in that neighborhood, because you'd have like law enforcement officials and stuff too. Like everybody would be there.
After returning to the house with the doctors, Fanny promptly fainted and stayed quite insensate during the examination of her husband.
Yeah.
Amos had been struck with an axe, with a blow so severe that it severed both his jugular vein and his carotid artery. It became quickly apparent that there was nothing they could have done to save him.
Yep. I think as soon as you would have hit either one of those, it would have been instant death, which I hope for.
A blow to the brain also didn't help matters either.
It didn't help, but he could probably survive it.
Yeah.
Depending on where it hit, you know?
Yeah. According to the November 23rd, 1890 edition of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, quote, Mr. Stillwell had been killed by an axe blow on the left side of his head. The wound was found to begin at the cheekbone, extend along the lower third of the ear and into the neck, being 4.5 inches in length. The deepest point was in the neck. The carotid artery had been severed, and death had resulted within a minute after the blow was struck. When found, the body was lying on the right side, the right arm under the head, the left arm lying on the bed. The feet were out of bed on the north side, and the toes were touching the carpet. The head was upon the pillow, though slightly removed from the deepest blood stains on the slip. There was a long streak of blood down the center of the bed and a mark of blood on the dead man's right leg, though no current of blood had flown in the direction of his position on the bed. End quote.
Hmm.
Dr. Joseph Hearn saw to Fanny, who was experiencing some sort of epileptic fit.
Yeah.
Well, and she had a history of epilepsy, so.
Yeah, so a high stress situation would have definitely triggered it.
It wasn't long before messengers were sent out to call for the police, John E. Stillwell, and Amos's eldest son, Richard, who lived about 0.5 mile from his father's home with his wife. Police began to investigate the scene of the crime. On the stairway, they found a trail of burnt matches that led out into the yard and the woodshed. Evidence suggested that the killer had escaped out the back door of the home, run through the yard, and then ran into the alley. Surprisingly, not far into the alley, police discovered a $5 bill that the killer had apparently dropped, along with a trail of silver coins and 4 more $5 bills. Just past that, a discarded empty pocketbook.
Oh, so like he took his wallet and then was in a rush and just didn't care. He just grabbed what he could and left.
Yep. The total contents discovered were less than $40, with some $20 missing.
Yeah.
Police were also able to recover the murder weapon, an old double-edged axe that had also been discarded in the alley behind a plank from a frame barn. Quote, it was a very heavy weapon with a fairly sharp edge, and for several days, according to the testimony of one of the servants, had lain almost entirely hidden under a heap of kindling in the woodhouse, end quote.
Hmm.
So whoever this person was had to have known that axe was in the woodshed. They didn't come with it.
So they would have had to have some sort of familiarity with the place.
According to the November 23rd, 1890 edition of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, quote, here the discoveries ended. At 5 o'clock in the morning, it was found that the evidence of the crime, all save the body, had been destroyed. The bedding had been removed and burned, and the room cleaned up. To this day, it is not known who did it or who commanded that it should be done. The one who did it concealed the fact. There must have been a motive. End quote.
That's crazy. Yeah. I mean, I get how they would be, like, she would be in a rush, or the people that like manage the house would be in a rush of like fixing things, getting rid of stuff, at least for the sake of like the kids and the fact that she had a seizure from the stress of the incident. I can see where that is, but oh my God, that would have never happened now, you know, like nobody touched this for like 6 months.
Yeah. Given the evidence, police surmised that the original intent of the crime was burglary. And it wasn't until Amos had been roused from sleep that the perpetrator decided to kill him in order to get away without being recognized.
I don't buy that.
Upon examination of the rest of the house, It was noted that the front door, which was usually bolted, had been wide open when Fanny ran out of the house to get help. Police found that the doors throughout the home and the back door were also unlocked, with no signs of forced entry or tampering with the locks.
Mm-hmm. So somebody would have had to not do that on purpose.
Typically, like, Amos was really sort of rigid about security. Like, he made sure, like, all the doors were bolted, like, that the house was locked up tight each night.
Yeah. When you make a certain amount of money, I mean, you always have that kind of hovering over you, especially, like, in the kind of work he's in, too. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he wasn't super well-liked by most of, like, the lower class and stuff. Mm-hmm. So there was probably always an undercurrent threat of people, like, disgruntled folks in his life.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Stillwell's funeral was on January 1st, 1889, and saw hundreds of mourners. Around 1:30 p.m., several people filled the home, yard, and the street to pay their respects. Amos was in a casket in the front parlor, because remember, this is back when they used mm-hmm. to have funerals in the home, where a service was read at 2 p.m. by the Reverend John Davis of the Episcopal Church, followed by a prayer. Mr. Stillwell's remains were then taken to Mount Olivet Cemetery, where he was laid to rest. 5 days later, the coroner's jury was able to talk to Fanny about what she saw and heard that night. Up until that time, she had been under the constant care of Dr. Hearn, who stated that she was very shaken up and likely to swoon at any time.
Yeah.
2 weeks later, the coroner's jury decided that, quote, Mr. Stillwell died from the effects of a blow from an axe in the hands of a person unknown, end quote.
We got nothing.
As you can imagine, the murder of a high-profile member of the community was big news and made all of Hannibal's residents understandably nervous until the killer was caught.
Mm-hmm.
The Pinkerton Detective Agency was called in to assist in the investigation, and Richard Stillman, Amos's oldest son, who was now 32, offered a $1,000 reward, or almost $33,000 today, for the capture of the person or persons responsible.
Wow. It's a big deal.
Richard, along with the rest of his family, agreed with the police assessment that this was a case of burglary gone wrong. However, many of the Hannibal residents thought it more likely that the killer was someone a bit closer to home.
Yeah.
If we look back at Fanny, we need to remember that she was very young when she married Amos. In fact, she's only 8 years older than his eldest child.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to note that Richard apparently was very fond of his stepmother, and she was nothing but kind to him. But that was like the extent of their relationship.
Yeah, because I'm sure it was super weird for him.
Yeah, but apparently they got along very, very well.
That's good. It's not always the case.
Yeah. Outwardly, the Stillwells seemed to have a happy marriage, but Amos was getting older, and he was very set in his ways by the time he married Fanny. Amos was known to be difficult to live with, and he ran a tight ship at home, hating needless waste and expenses. Even though he ran a pork processing plant, Amos himself was a vegetarian and a bit of a health nut.
Hmm.
He not only controlled what the family consumed, but he also refused to let Fanny wear anything other than a heavy cotton nightgown to bed, believing that the more modern, lacy styles of the day were quote-unquote unhealthy.
Sure. That's the word for it.
Amos also didn't believe in doctors, but that didn't prevent Fanny from regularly consulting with Dr. Joseph C. Hearn, who lived just around the block from the Stillwells. If town gossip is to be believed, the pair spent so much time at quote-unquote consulting that most in Hannibal believed they were in fact having an affair.
Yeah, I can see that.
And following Amos's murder, many believe that Dr. Hearn had something to do with it.
Is he a big dude?
Well, Dr. Joseph Hearn was a widower. His first wife, funnily enough, was named Fanny Brown.
Hmm.
Joseph was tall and had a commanding presence to the point that some found him to be domineering. Regardless, he was popular and kind to his friends, a fine physician, and a well-liked doctor. So he was a respected, well-liked member of the community.
Yeah.
Even with this information, Richard Stillwell held firm to the burglary gone wrong theory, and he used his money and influence to move the police investigation in that direction.
Convenient.
In addition to working at the pork processing plant, Richard owned and operated one of the largest cold storage and ice production plants in Missouri.
Oh, man, so he's stupid rich.
Yeah, he's got lots of money.
Because that's the newest technology of the day.
Yeah.
Dang.
Following Richard's direction, detectives turned their sights on members of the African-American community in Hannibal.
Of course they did.
Mm-hmm. And some of the earliest arrests occurred 2 weeks after the murder. These were a man named George Gibson and his mistress, Alice Ward.
Oh.
It's unclear the sort of evidence that led to their arrest, but the pair were examined by two men from the Pinkerton Agency. On January 28th, another African-American man named George Dixon was arrested, along with his white mistress. They were charged for, quote, unlawful cohabitation, end quote. And when asked why he was being arrested, he was informed that the night of the murder, he had been seen around Hannibal with an unusually large amount of money on his person.
Great. Let's pin him because he has too much money for being a black man in Missouri.
Yep.
Awesome. God.
With such lackluster evidence, all four parties were soon released, thankfully.
Good. I'm sure that traveled with him, though.
With so little to go on, the case soon turned cold, and the Pinkertons dropped out of the investigation. Then, in an unexpected move, on December 28th, 1889, almost a year to the date of the murder, Dr. Joseph C. Hearn and Fanny Stillwell got married at 4 p.m. at the home that she had previously shared with her late husband.
Convenient.
It was a small affair, with those in attendance being Richard, Mr. and Mrs. Perkins, Mrs. Brown, Fanny's three children, and Dr. Hearn's children, Virginia, age 14, Alan, age 12, Catherine, age 10, and Fanny Jr., age 5.
God.
At the time that Joseph and Fanny tied the knot, he was 38 and she was 41. This marriage understandably renewed interest in the Stillwell case.
Yeah, I bet.
With many wondering if the quote-unquote rumors about the pair had more grains of truth to them than the residents may have realized.
And just because of the nature of it, I bet it just spread like wildfire. Like, everybody was talking about it.
Mm-hmm. In fact, as the newlyweds headed to the train station to board a train headed to Chicago for their honeymoon, a mob of people followed them, yelling things such as, "Fanny, is that you?" and "Hit him in the head with an axe and ask me no questions."
Dang.
Yeah.
That's vile.
Yeah. John E. Stillwell, Amos's nephew, who he owned the business with, tried to use his clout to force a grand jury investigation, but the prosecution refused to entertain any motive other than burglary. The grand jury didn't return any indictments, and in a move that I believe was done out of spite, the now married Fanny Hearn forced her step-nephew to retire from Amos's pork packing company.
Yeah, she wants it done.
As like an FU type of thing.
Yeah, punishment.
Meanwhile, Richard raised the reward for information to $10,000, or around $337,000 today.
Oh, man.
And over the next 4 years, a handful of arrests would be made, but with no real progress or resolution for the case. One of those arrests and trials was that of Stanley Kendricks, an African-American man. He, along with Bertha Miller, Sam Rhodes, and Esther Dick, all African-Americans, were arrested on suspicion that they had planned the burglary and killed Amos as a result. Bertha lived in the front room of a home where she was frequently visited by her friend Esther. The back room was occupied by an elderly African-American woman who overheard the pair talking about Stanley Kendricks. Stanley had lived in Hannibal, working as a servant. When he fell sick, Dr. Hearn took care of him. Following his recovery, he sought out Esther to see if she could find someone to help him commit a crime. That's how Esther pulled in Sam, who had previously been employed by Amos Stillwell for over a decade. Following this, Stanley let the group know his intention to kill Amos because he had been asked to do so.
Yep, I was just going to say, the doctor used saving his life as leverage.
Although all of them had the same story, there was not enough hard evidence to prove that any of them had in fact killed Amos, and the case against all of them was dropped.
That would be maddening.
Yeah.
Because that's probably definitely what happened.
The grand jury would meet 5 more times over the Stillwell case, and each time after reviewing the evidence, they would hand down no indictments. At some point during all of this, Dr. Joseph and Fanny Hearns packed up and moved to San Diego, California, where Joseph set up a medical practice. Then, in a surprising move, Fanny filed for divorce in August of 1894, charging cruelty and failure to provide.
Interesting.
The divorce was mutual, and Joseph did not contest it. Following the divorce, Fanny changed her name back to Stillwell. Funnily enough, they would get remarried in September of 1895, so the next year.
Mm-hmm.
Even in California, the pair couldn't escape word of the murder. And when an article published in the San Francisco Chronicle connected Dr. Joseph to the slaying, he was so pissed that he decided to sue the paper for libel to the tune of $200,000, or around $7.4 million today in damages.
Whoa.
So, in July of 1895, Joseph and his attorneys, as well as attorneys for the Chronicle, traveled across the country back to Hannibal to take depositions. Things get interesting. This wasn't the smartest move on Dr. Joseph's part.
No.
As Richard had changed his tune about his father's murder, and was starting to believe the rumors that had been swirling about town regarding his stepmother and her favorite physician.
Yeah, they've been out of their lives long enough that I'm sure enough suggestion was able to get to him.
He believed it so much that he canceled the reward and started to do a little digging on his own for when he planned to take the case to court. And in a brilliant move on his part, Richard volunteered to be deposed in support of the San Francisco Chronicle during the libel case.
Ooh.
During his testimony, Richard stated that he had recently learned from several reliable sources that Dr. Joseph and Fanny had, in fact, been in love prior to his father's murder, and that they had relations. He was told that Joseph didn't think Amos was a good match for Fanny, so he planned to do what he could to secure her a divorce. Well, that method of securing said divorce was hiring a man to quote-unquote slug Amos for $2.50, or around $82 today.
Wow, that's a cheap murder.
Yeah. One of Richard's sources, a woman named Mrs. C.P. Haywood, told him about a time that Joseph confided in her that he had been at the Stillwell home while Amos was away in St. Louis. When Amos came home unexpectedly, he'd had to hide naked in the shadows while Amos walked right past him. He told Mrs. Haywood that if he had gotten caught, he would have shot Amos and made it look like a burglary.
Oh boy.
According to Dr. Joseph, quote, "No one ever suspects doctors or ministers," end quote.
Right.
A few days later, the grand jury met again to hear testimony from all the witnesses who had delivered testimony for the San Francisco Chronicle. This, of course, included Richard, who had obtained a signed deposition from Mrs. C.P. Haywood. Other damning evidence that was brought to light included Molly, the daughter, had never slept away from home prior to the night of the murder. The first people on the scene who saw Amos's body believe it had been moved prior to their arrival.
Mm-hmm.
And several people who saw Fanny that night stated that she had been wearing a fancy modern nightgown instead of a dowdy cotton one.
Oh, that would be a really big thing to point out.
In fact, Jim Abbey, a former detective for the Missouri Pacific Railroad, stated that he had discovered a plain cotton nightgown with bloodstains on its sleeves in an outhouse on the Stillwell property.
Oh.
All this damning evidence resulted in both Dr. Joseph and Fanny Stillwell getting indicted and arrested for first-degree murder.
Dang. Man, to be in that courtroom, that would have been insane.
Oh my God, to be a fly on the wall in that courtroom.
Mm-hmm. There would definitely not be order in that court.
So much tea being spilled. Goddamn. The pair were taken to Palmyra by Sheriff Pratt, where they stayed in the county jail. Fanny was placed in a room with a woman named Virginia Todd, who was accused of murdering her daughter.
Oh.
Casual.
Hmm.
And Joseph was placed in a cell with a man named Doug Rowland, who was charged with grand larceny.
A little better.
I just thought those were fun facts. The pair would be tried separately, because remember how they got remarried in September? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was very convenient.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph's trial started on December 9th, 1895, in Bowling Green, Missouri. After 2 weeks of evidence and testimony, the jury returned a verdict of not guilty due to lack of hard evidence tying Joseph to the murder.
Damn.
And Dr. Joseph Hearn was released from custody. Meanwhile, Fanny had been released on a $5,000 bail, or $185,000 today, but after Joseph's verdict, she was also cleared and didn't have to sit trial for murder.
That's heartbreaking.
The trial was a bit of a slap in the face for the residents of Hannibal, who had been waiting 7 years to see justice served for one of their most prominent citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the justice system had cleared them, Dr. Joseph Hearn and Fanny Stillwell were still found guilty in the eyes of the public.
Yeah.
Dr. Joseph continued his lawsuit against the San Francisco Chronicle, and after 7 months and two trials, he won the case and received $10,000, or $369,000 today, in damages.
I bet you that just covered the court costs by the end of it.
Probably, yeah. To this day, the mystery surrounding who killed Amos Stillwell has never been solved. As for Fanny, she passed away at the age of 72 in 1921 and is buried in North Carolina. I can't tell you what became of Molly, because actually the only knowledge I have of Molly is what I found in the newspaper. I couldn't find anything else about her anywhere.
Dang.
But Harold lived to be 74, passing in 1956, and Earl lived to be 93, passing away in 1978.
That's crazy.
And Richard, the eldest, passed away at the age of 71 in 1928. And that is the story of the Stillwell murder.
How frustrating.
I know. Because all signs point to the Stanley Kendrick, him being the person that was paid the $250.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Again, $2.50
mm-hmm.
to orchestrate this and murder Amos. And obviously, Dr. Hearn is involved in some capacity.
Right. And so is Fanny.
Yep.
You know, she was too.
Just frustrating and sad.
Just get a divorce, guys.
Yeah, don't kill your husbands or your wives.
Just divorce. The insurance payout is not worth it. The inheritance is never worth it. More money, more problems.
Yeah.
Less murder.
And don't traumatize your kids having your husband murdered with an axe.
Yep, their dad.
That's a dick move.
Yep, in their home.
In the same room. That's fucked.
There's no way they didn't see something.
If you're interested in ad-free content, consider supporting us with a one-time donation either over on Buy Me a Coffee or our Venmo page, both of which are in our link tree and in the show notes.
Hello, Twisted Humans. Do you find yourself wanting to know more about the latest murder, conspiracy, cult, or haunting?
Then this is the podcast for you.
In 1952, there was a record high of UFOs reported. 1,500 sightings.
There has been evidence of human sacrifice, devil worship, and it is haunted by more spirits than can be counted.
A family of two adults and two kids reportedly saw a giant flying thing with glowing red eyes.
And meanwhile, the family's nanny that helped Veronica to care for her and Lucian's children was found bludgeoned to death in the basement of their family home. I'm Alicia.
And I'm Sierra. And this is Twisted and Uncorked.
On that note, this month's podcast plug is the Twisted and Uncorked podcast. From Victoria, British Columbia and Cincinnati, Ohio, Alicia and Sierra have a twisted fascination with the dark, spooky, and unimaginable. Every Tuesday, they rotate through categories including conspiracy, cult, disappeared, haunted, murderless, serial killer, unsolved, and listener suggested. And we will have a link to their show in the show notes.
Awesome.
And this week's listener question is also from our friend Brent.
And hi, Brent.
He would like to know, what inspired you to pick the topic of your podcast?
That question's on you.
I enjoyed hearing about older crimes. Oh, I just saw a duck. Sorry. Squirrel. There's a bunch of ducks in my backyard in the trees, which is funny. I liked a bunch of the older stories that would be told on the Lore podcast and that are still being told on the Lore podcast. So that got me interested in learning about more older crimes. And that's what inspired me to make the show about that versus doing it on like more modern crimes, just because for one, it's more interesting to kind of see what you can find about it. And on the other, I feel like even the ones that are really, really bad, they don't hit as hard because they're not as current.
Yeah.
And like there's a bunch of removal from the crime and you're less likely to find like crime scene photos and all that kind of stuff that like, I don't know, it doesn't seem nearly as like grisly and I'm blanking on the word.
Graphic.
And then it's not as oversaturated as some of these cases tend to be in modern media.
Because everybody does Jeffrey Dahmer, everybody does
Gacy or Scott Peterson or the JonBenet case. Like there's
so many murders that haven't seen the light of day in a long time that we're able to showcase.
Yeah. And a lot of cases that people hadn't heard about that actually brought about real change. Like,
Well, like that candy poisoning
that
brought about some change. The
Mary Ellen Wilson, the case that kind of brought about changes in
CPS.
Yeah, like child safety legislation and things like that. So cases like that.
Well, and like all the cases from the nursery rhymes, breaking those down. Like nobody really knows where they come from. They just know the song.
And then it's like actually based on something real. Hope that answers your question, Brent. And on that note, what is something good you'd like to share?
I am, I'd say probably halfway done with our move to the new home.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really excited. We are moving all the big stuff tomorrow. And so I'm doing some prep after this to kind of get everything situated, get it everything as much as we can kind of packed and ready to go so we can really utilize the U-Haul. Because that's always the thing, you know, you've got one day to really make it work. Yeah, it's good that I'm almost done so I can kind of pivot and focus on getting another job and making the new home homey and making sure the dogs are comfortable too, because it's been a tough process for them.
Yeah.
This is the first move we'll have with my partner's working dog, and he's already kind of anxious just because of the breed.
Yeah.
Belgian Malinois are, you know, intense, super focused. They pay more attention than other breeds. And so the sooner we're able to stop kind of shipping them back and forth, I think the easier it'll be overall, because it's stressing him out. Like Willie doesn't, he hasn't been eating as much, and Chief, you know, he doesn't sleep as well. So we're rushing to get back to a normal for them more than us, I think.
Yeah. But
big moves this week. Hopefully I'll have even better something good. Like my something good will be in the home.
Yeah.
What about you?
I am waiting to hear more about two potential job leads that I have right now. Ooh. There is one that I'm way more excited about than the other one, just because it's more kind of like my dream job. So
ooh.
I kind of hope that one pans out more than the other one.
I'm crossing my fingers and toes.
Send all the good vibes my way that one will pan out.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm hoping that next week I'll have my something good will be, I got a gerb. So, fingers crossed that manifests itself.
Absolutely.
All right. Shall we?
Yes.
A great way to support the show, if you want to help out, but you can't do so financially, is to leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, Good Pods, Podcast Addict, and or Audible.
Looking for more content? You can find us online at yieldcrimepodcast.com. If you'd like to see pictures from this week's episode, not to mention bonus content and funny memes, make sure to follow us on Twitter at yieldcrimepod and on Facebook and Instagram at yieldcrimepodcast. On TikTok? Of course you are. Follow us at Yield Crime Podcast.
And we will be having a sale on our TeePublic shop this week. Mm-hmm. You can enjoy 35% off all of our merchandise April 10th through the 14th. And we have some of our newer merch that was voted on by you on our site. And I am going to release some more designs for you to vote on this week, so they can be available for the second sale that we will have in April. So nice. Keep your eyes peeled for Instagram for that, so you can cast your vote.
Awesome.
If you want a playlist of all our episodes on YouTube, click the link in our show notes or in our link tree and subscribe today for not only a list of our full catalog, but a separate list as well, just of our Can You Crack the Cramp Word segments.
And on that note, as always, I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Madison.
And we'll see you next time with another tale
as old as crime.